that was the point where the seller, initially, he sounded like he was cooperative. He was willing to extend. The communication was, you know, okay. But then he started to get very indecisive. We were kind of joking around that we weren't sure if he was bipolar by the time that we were ready to close, because one day it seemed like, okay, I'm ready. No, I'm not. And 2 to 3 days prior to the settlement date, we were thinking that we weren't going to be able to close.
Welcome to the Multifamily Deal Lab podcast, where we dissect a deal before your eyes and ears so you can discover the strategies and tactics that got each deal to the finish line. Strategies and tactics that you can put in your own toolbox to get you to the closing table. From sourcing the deal, raising, due diligence to the property takeover, Multifamily Deal Lab shows how you too can get the deal done. And now here's your host, David Lindahl.
Everybody, welcome to Multifamily Deal Lab. I'm your host, Dave Lindahl.
On today's interview, I am interviewing Adam Balsinger and Charles Sheeman. They closed on a 64-unit deal in Charlotte. And what you're going to discover during today's podcast is, number one, how they cultivated their broker relationships to get this deal coming in. They actually own 200 doors in that particular marketplace, so they'll talk about that. They're going to talk about how they get their offer accepted before the call to offers. So if you've been in this business any length of time, you know there's always a call to offers, highs and best, sharpen your pencil, blah, blah, blah. They get their offer accepted before that. How did they do it? You're going to find out. We're going to talk about what underwriting precautions they took because they were underwriting during the COVID pandemic and what was involved in this deal that actually made it a little bit easier. When they went to the closing on this particular deal, they got one extension, but then when they needed a second extension, the seller didn't want to extend. So you will find out why they needed those extensions, number one, so you can avoid running into the same problem. And then number two, they're going to talk about how they got creative and made the seller five different offers, you know, kind of like a pick and choose to get that second extension, which he didn't want to give, which meant they would have lost their deposit money going into the deal. And so you're going to find out which one the investor chose and why, and that's going to be a surprise. And at the very end, they're going to talk about the lessons learned during this particular deal. And there were four key lessons that they learned during this deal where they will not do the same thing on the next deal. So before I bring them on, I want to give you a little head stuff. This, I'm going to share a poem with you. It's called Invictus. This is a poem that I read many, many, many years ago. And after reading it, I realized that, wow, this poem is talking to me directly. And I used to read this poem at the end of my three-day events. That would be the last thing I'd say before I'd walk off that stage, the Multifamily Millions Bootcamp. It just resonates with everybody. I remember when I would walk down that center aisle and I would always write it out. Even though I know this by heart, I would always write it out because you have those moments of anxiety and I didn't want to miss a line. And then as I was walking down the center aisle, somebody would always grab it from my hand so they could keep it as a keepsake. So it's called Invictus and it's by William Henley. Out of the night that covers me, black as the pit from pole to pole, I thank whatever gods may be for my unconquerable soul. In the fell clutch of circumstance, I have not winced nor cried aloud. Under the bludgeonings of chance, my head is bloody, but not unbowed. Beyond this place of wrath and tears looms but the horrors of the shade. And yet the menace over the years finds and shall find me unafraid. It matters not how straight the gate, how charged with punishments the scroll. For I am the master of my fate. Yes, I am the captain of my soul. That is each and every one of us. So without further ado, let's go to the main interview of the podcast and bring on our guests. I have Charles Sheeman and Adam Balsinger with me, and they just did a 64-unit deal. So let's go through, let's dissect this deal. So 64 units, where is it?
Charlotte, North Carolina.
All right. So how did you choose that market?
So through careful selection, you know, after we had taken some RE Mentor programs, we had kind of baffled around all across the East Coast. And after about a year, we got smart and said, you know, we have to listen to everybody's advice and choose a target market. So we spent a lot of time doing research and looking at deals in different markets. Adam already lived in Charlotte. And I said, you know, we're really overthinking this. You live in one of the best markets in the country. Why don't we just pick that? And there was a lot to like about it, a lot of job growth, a lot of population growth, a lot of positive metrics. So he was down there. I relocated here in 2019. Then our third Oak and our third partner relocated down in the Charlotte area last year. So it just worked out because we all centered ourselves around there and chose a great market.
Wow, that's excellent. So how many doors do you have down there now?
We have just over 200 doors. Actually, we're in all three of our target states right now, which are North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia. So we have an asset in Atlanta that's 92 units. We have a 48-unit property in South Carolina, and then the 64-unit we just closed here in Charlotte.
Yeah, you're in some good markets. I like those East Coast markets. I like them especially for me because being from Boston, I can fly down and fly back on the same day, you know, be home for dinner. That's how I choose my markets now.
Yeah. We drive most of the time down to the Atlanta property, but that was one of the things that we really wanted was to be central, something that we could get to in a day and back, you know, and our investors like that too.
You know, through the years teaching since 2002, a lot of people have asked me the question, if I could move anywhere, where would I go? What market would you put me in? And I've given, you know, that advice many, many times and people have done it and moved and, you know, that's probably the best thing somebody can do if they're mobile. So you guys being in the market, that's a huge advantage.
Agreed.
All right. So let's talk about this particular 64 unit deal. In the middle of the COVID pandemic. So how did you find this particular deal? How did it come to you?
Yeah. So Charles handles acquisition. So do you want to take this question, Charles?
Sure. It really came through broker relationships, which is really how most of our deals come to us at this point. We have a couple of good relationships. And one of the reasons that, you know, we decided to center in the market is that, as you said, Dave, it makes it a lot easier just to build those relationships. I definitely take advantage of it. And every chance I get to get in front of them, I do. If we can take them for lunch or take them for coffee or go tour a property, I take every chance to get in front of them and get FaceTime.
That's great. So I've always talked about the strategy with the coaching program, the mentorship is to somebody struggling. I say, well, then take a broker to lunch, you know, every day for the next 30 days, or at least once a week, take a new broker to lunch. And that usually works, you know, doesn't have to be every day, but if you can get a broker every couple of days, not every broker is going to give you deals, as you know, but you're going to start a relationship. The best way to start a relationship is that one-on-one time.
Yeah. We've taken guys to and gals dinner, lunch, Charlotte Hornets games. I mean, like you said, anything that we can do to get in front of and hopefully it's something that they like doing and we're not dragging them along to something that they don't want to do.
Well, are you doing really are you finding commonality? Are you going through that process?
Of course.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually this deal, we had seen it as an off-market deal. The seller's financials were kind of a mess. So we had made an offer, an off-market opportunity. And then a couple months later, the seller wasn't able to get what they wanted off-market. They took the property to market. We saw it pop back up with the updated financials. We were already familiar with the property. So we actually submitted a preemptive offer probably, what, Charles, about a month before the actual call to offers date. And we had our LOI accepted well before the call for offers date came around.
Wow, that's pretty good. So I mean, typically they'll wait for best and final. So how did you get your offer accepted a month before they went to market?
So it helped having the deal off market beforehand because we already had a head start on everybody else. We had driven by the property a few times and we went, you know, we had a really good relationship with the broker and it just worked out. And the day that I toured the property, I remember it was October 1st. I had lunch with him right beforehand or right afterward, I think. And we looked at a lot of deals over the last 2 years, but we hadn't gotten one done with them yet. And he said to me, what are we going to do a deal? I said, how about the one we just saw? And then from that point, we more or less kind of worked the terms out. We submitted an LOI and you know, we had two or three counters from the seller because he still insisted on a little more money. So we went back and said, okay, the deal still makes sense. Let's give him the price he wants. I think it's a solid area that's going to appreciate. So let's get it done.
So you had said that the financials were a mess. Can you explain that?
Yeah. So in this case, wasn't really so much a mess in the traditional sense, but they were outdated. So we had started looking at the deal in February 2018, and they gave us financials from August of 2018.
And wow.
Yeah. And I told the broker, I said, listen, I'm glad to use these as a starting point, but I can't give the guy what he wants based on this. I said, if he can give me current financials, I'm glad to see what we can do, but I'm not going to pay 2020 pricing for 2018 financials.
what was his rationale for giving you the those financials August of?
You know, from having dealt with the seller, he's not a bad guy, but he's very difficult. And I think he was just playing hardball. I think he wanted to see what he can get and was just fishing around before he actually decided to sell. Mm-hmm. And then I guess probably after about 2 years of nurturing that relationship, the broker finally got him to put it on the market, and that required him to release the current financials.
Let's circle back. You said that your acquisitions, Charles, and so Adam, what's your role? And then you got a third partner too. And I understand the third partner is one of yours' fathers?
Yeah, my dad. Yep.
Your dad? Okay. So your role is what, Adam?
I'm investor relations.
Okay. And what about your father?
He is more kind of a financial overview. He's a retired CFO and CPA. So he's more of a kind of like a CFO type of a role.
So is he doing underwriting?
Actually, Charles does our initial underwriting, and then he is the kind of final sniff test, if you will.
All right, good. So that's a good way for everybody that's out there with the partners on how to separate your roles. So that works out well.
It took us a while to get to that point, Dave.
Was everybody trying to do everything?
Yeah, well, I think there was a lot of areas where we were stepping on each other's toes initially and trying to figure out who's best suited for this, who's best suited for that. So, you know, it's been an evolution, but we feel like we really have it figured out really well now.
How did you guys meet?
We initially met at your Perfecting the Presentation event, October 4th, 2017. Oh. Yeah. And we went to that. I had lunch with them the first day. Then we connected and had lunch the next day. And then we saw each other again the following month at sponsorship. And then we started saying, listen, maybe it makes sense for us to work together. So it just kind of developed from there. And then we saw each other at a few more events. So it really started with the Ari Mentor organization and the events we went to there.
Excellent. All right. So you guys, was there a strength and weakness type of a thing? You realized somebody was strong at something and somebody was weak at another, or it was just the personality? You realize you got along good and you make good partners.
It really started more personality-wise, I would say. I don't think that we had as much science to it initially as we probably should have. But, you know, we kind of had an idea what our strengths and weaknesses were. And then we just found out further as we started working together. It really wasn't until we closed our first deal that we said, okay, once again, we need to get a little smarter. And we need to figure out actual roles so we're not just diving into everything.
Mm-hmm. The evolution of the business.
I run a wholesaling business too. Real estate related. And so I've had partnerships before. So I think that I was actually a little bit more strategic maybe than Charles was. So personality, yes, but I think you can tell a lot about somebody's, you know, what their potential strengths and weaknesses are going to be from interacting with them, getting to know somebody over a couple lunches, talking to them about, you know, what their strengths and weaknesses are, what they've had success with and what they haven't. So I actually thought that Charles was really going to be somebody that offset my weaknesses or what I don't like to do by what he's good at or what he likes to do.
Good. On this particular deal during the underwriting or the deal itself, what did you do to reduce the risk of COVID? Number one in the underwriting and then number two, perhaps in the contract. Anything in particular?
Yes, two things that stand out. So one thing that we like in terms of the deal itself is that 73% of the property is a subsidized tenant base. So that was really one of what's that?
Which subsidy?
It's a mix of four different agencies. The primary one is the Charlotte Housing Authority, but really Section 8 type tenants.
Okay.
So our thought with that is we have security in that. And that was really a selling point in the pitch we made to investors, because my thinking is, who knows if we're going to have a second lockdown? Who knows what's going to happen? So at least we know that barring a national calamity, we're still going to receive government-sponsored funds. So at least we felt pretty good about that. And in terms of the deal itself, one of the things we did, especially being it's a C property, even though it is primarily subsidized, we chose to underwrite it with a minimum of 12% vacancy throughout the life of the deal. So even with that, we still wound up with a 16% return. So we felt pretty confident that, okay, we should be able to do better than 12% vacancy. You know, even if we were total amateurs, we should be able to hit 12% vacancy.
What was it upon takeover? What was the economic?
So economic was right around 90. So it was around 10% altogether.
Oh, that's pretty good. That's really good for a C property.
Yeah.
So,
and really a lot of it's attributed to the subsidies, because those payments come in like clockwork. Right. So that way you're not waiting for tenants to pay rent whenever they want.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Anything in particular in the contract that you changed for reducing your risk to COVID?
Nothing to reduce the risk. It did wind up becoming a nail biter because we wound up having two extensions, which weren't initially part of the original agreement.
We're going to get into that.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you about that.
Yeah.
But before I get there though, what was the price on the deal?
$7.4 million.
And what was the raise?
$2,695,000.
All right. So 2.6. How did you do it? Adam, you want to jump in?
Yes, I would love to. So We did a lot of webinars. So our, I think, investor relations process has really evolved over time. We're trying to get a little bit better at being a match for investors rather than going out and having to, you know, meet and shake everybody's hand individually at networking events. I think that that's a really great way to get started, but you reach kind of a critical mass point, right, where it's hard to be out enough to continue putting new investors into pipeline. So we've really been working a lot on that. But for this deal specifically, we did a lot of webinar presentations. And one of the things that's been really critical to not just us being able to successfully close this deal, but the deal we had done prior to this one was we've been able to, through networking, meet an international group out of South America that has come in and brought some pretty significant capital to both of the last two deals that we've done. So they were committed for 1.8 on this deal. And they actually came in with the entire raise on our last deal. And so that's just been through networking that we were able to make a connection with that group.
Where does guy a contact
a
like
guy that?
That
knows a guy type of a situation.
Oh. Yeah, I was just about to ask, where does a contact like that come from? So it's like three steps. Mm-hmm. Six steps to what's that?
Seven steps exactly? To Kevin Bacon, I think.
Yeah, right, exactly. All right. So during the due diligence, did you guys encounter anything unusual?
No, I don't think there was anything specific. You know, it's a 66, 70s built property. So there were, when we have a structural engineer go out with us when we tour the property, there were some recommendations that they made, but they were all very minor, some drainage and some helical piers on a building or two. But we had a pretty thick cushion for our CapEx budget. So it didn't impact what we had projected in terms of our capital expenditures. So we were fine.
Okay, good. So other than the close, your management team, Josh, you want to jump back in on, well, how did you choose your management team, management company? You're doing third party?
Yeah. Right now, always third party. So eventually I think we probably would like to scale up where we have our own, but we're not there just yet. So normally we've been having success with the 50 to 100 unit space. So we're focusing on property management companies that have track records in that area. What we've realized, and I believe you said this many times, is that it's easy to find a good property manager for a small multifamily or for 100 units and up. But when you're in that medium-sized space, there really aren't that many to choose from. And you have to vet them carefully to make sure you're getting, you know, there's probably two or three good ones in every market. And it's really vetting them to see which one is going to be the right fit for you. So ironically, the one that we chose, we've been working with them for about 6 or 7 months prior to getting the deal on the contract. And they came to us from the broker, because he actually has them manage a multifamily property that he owns personally. So I said, okay, they came on good reference. It's something he's using in his own personal portfolio. And after working with them and now having them take the property over for us, so far we've been very happy and they've been on top of everything.
That's great. Yeah, I found that brokers are a good resource only because if the management company that they refer screws the deal up, they risk not getting the deal back on the resale.
Yep.
Right? All right, so let's go to... anything unusual during the takeover? When you took over the property, did any surprises?
Thankfully, no. You know, the seller was pretty transparent. I mean, he really, you know, anytime we requested information, he gave it to us. So I don't think we had anything that wasn't expected.
No thousands of outstanding maintenance requests?
Not yet, anyway. So we've only owned it for 11 days, so not yet. But
oh, wow.
No.
That is brand new. Normally when you have those extended amount of maintenance requests that are due on the takeover, there's usually a line in the office, you know, a line of people complaining and a line of people giving their notice in the first week. That's what I found early.
Part of what may have helped to mitigate that is that we kept the same on-site property manager that the previous owner had. Even though we have a third-party management company overseeing her, I guess being a lot of the tenants already have that relationship, they probably figure, okay, even though it's a change in ownership and change in management, we still have the same face there, so we can't say, okay, let's try something different.
Makes sense. All right, so back to Adam. Talk about the closing. Almost didn't close on time or didn't close on time. What happened?
We wound up with two extensions, and the first one was with smooth sailing, I would say, for the most part. But
so why did you have to request the first extension? What didn't go right?
Well, so the first extension, one of the things that helped us to get the deal was that we were really attempting to close before 2021. So the initial plan, and one of the reasons that the seller went with us, was that we were going to be closing prior to the end of 2020. But when we got into the deal and trying to get everything done in probably what, Charles, about 45 days, something like that, was going to prove to be a bit of a challenge. And so we just were not really able to execute on that when we got into things. And so we went pretty early in the process and extended the deal then into January. And then so when January came around, the lender needed a couple of extra days. You know, we were looking to get essentially a 7-day extension from the seller so that we could get everything, the ribbon on it with the lender. And that was the point where the seller decided to, initially, he sounded like he was cooperative. He was willing to extend. He was going to charge us an extension fee in order to be able to do it. But initially, the communication was, okay, begrudgingly, okay. But then nothing was ever signed. And he started to get very indecisive. It was like, we were kind of joking around that we weren't sure if he was bipolar by the time that we were ready to close, because one day it seemed like, okay, I'm ready. No, I'm not. Well, maybe. No, not at all. Totally forget it. And really 2 to 3 days prior to the settlement date, we were thinking that we weren't going to be able to close. We started reaching out to essentially all kinds of different contacts that we had to even try to get essentially a hard money loan to close that we would then refinance them out with the actual loan within 7 days. So we were almost trying to get transactional funding to be able to get the deal done. And so Charles stayed on top of the seller and was able to get direct connection to the seller. And we wound up kind of, godfather making him an offer that he couldn't really refuse. We threw out several different options in terms of, hey, listen, all we need is 7 days.
Before we get to the options part, so did everything else fail? Did the hard money fail?
So we were able to get some hard money, but it wasn't going to be enough. And unsurprisingly, because we were, we were scrambling 48 hours prior to settlement and, to get somebody that was going to pony up the full nut for what we needed to be able to close, we were able to get some funding, but not enough. We were short by, I want to say, probably what, Charles, about $1 million, or would have been short had we tried that hard money route?
Probably a good $1.5 million even.
And Charles, what were the offers to the seller?
So we threw out 5 different options. We weren't really expecting him to come back and accept a little piece of all of them, but I think he did. So we offered, initially we said, okay, we can give you $50,000 extra, just hard money. We'll put it down and apply it to the purchase price. Then we said we can give you a $50,000 one-time extension fee, totally separate, not applied to the purchase price on top of it. Then we also threw out the option of potentially offering him part of our share in the GP for the deal. And then we also, one thing he was very big on was his staff. So part of the reason that he was a little bit reluctant to let it go is that he didn't want to let his staff go. So he wanted to give them some type of compensation package and give them a nice little bonus for so many years of service. So we also offered to give direct payments to the employees so that way they can go right to them and they can be a gift from him. So we offered him those things, and there was a fifth one, which eludes me at this point, but he came back and I wasn't really sure what his position on it was, because I said, it seems almost like he's accepting a little bit of each of them.
And so what did it take to get it done?
So we wound up giving him $50,000 additional hard money on the contract, $50,000 one-time extension fee, and part of our percentage in the GP. So he's technically a partner in the deal with us.
I guess so. Interesting.
We had exhausted, I think, almost everything at that. Charles had gone to his office. I was actually in Atlanta touring our asset down there the day before settlement. And Charles went to his office to try to sweet talk him into an extension, and he wasn't there. And so, you know, this was the Charles sent this out through communication, this offer, and it was like late afternoon, the day before we were supposed to settle. And it was just our Hail Mary of let's do whatever we can do to keep this thing from falling apart here at the last second.
Very creative. Excellent. So what lessons were learned during this deal?
There was definitely
Charles,
a few of them.
You want to take this one?
Yeah. So I think some of the bigger ones were just operational mistakes that we had made and things that we need to do better on the future, which we've committed to doing that. So
what were those?
Well, one thing we've always been adamant about is that we usually wait until about halfway through our due diligence period to start our loan application and our offering docs, just because we feel that we want to make sure that we're fairly confident before laying that money out and not getting it back. But one thing we've realized is that, you know what, going forward, we have to just start it as soon as the PSA is signed. And, you know, why obviously we don't want to throw $25,000 or $30,000 away. We have to accept that as a cost of being in the business and just make sure that we're selective enough with our deals that we're not throwing that money away. So I think starting those two things earlier in the process would be a big help. And also getting our investor marketing materials ready earlier so that way we can disseminate them to the investors and get them in front of them sooner. So those three things would probably make a big difference and will allow us to close in a faster time frame going forward.
Yeah, I think.
Hold on for one second. Start the loan earlier, get the investment package out earlier. And what was the third one?
And also start the offering docs with the SEC attorney.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Those always take longer than you think.
Yes.
Yeah. So much longer than you think. Yeah. And I think another thing, too, is so it's great that we have this group, this international group that writes big checks and brings big, contributes significant amounts of the raise. But we're almost overly reliant on them to a certain extent. So if they are dragging their feet, getting things situated, and, you know, it's a different culture. So right now is like summer for them. They are feet up, kicked back, not really doing much work, not really much of a sense of urgency for things the way that we have here.
South Americans typically don't have that sense of urgency.
Correct.
For anything.
Right. You know, part of, I think, ultimately the delay in things was also that we were kind of waiting on them to fulfill their commitment. And so part of one of the big things I'm working on is, okay, you know, we shouldn't need to be totally reliant and it's just first come, first serve. This was the biggest raise we had done to date yet. And they had contributed a large amount of money. But so having secondary, second and third options to be able to come in is something that we're going to be doing on the very next deal instead of relying so much on one group.
Yeah. You know, the conversation always is because, you know, if you have a large group that you or one particular person or a group that you rely on and, you know, if the biggest fear is what if they don't perform? Okay. So then the conversation is, do we have them put upfront money or can we get them to put upfront money? Mm-hmm. And so that they'll have that same sense of urgency. Have you thought about that?
Yeah. So that's one of the things that we're talking about with them. One of the other things, you've said this on countless occasions, that you don't be a pain in the butt to work with, make things easy. Mm-hmm. You make it easy for people to do business with you. And, the group is great. They're phenomenal. They're all great people. But they can be kind of a pain in the butt between a combination of them wanting a lot from us in terms of investor relations, their requirements, I'm using that in air quotes for communication and reporting is a little bit laborious. It takes a lot of work to get them the information that they want. I think we're almost looking to put them in the corner a little bit for the next deal anyway. But that's a really good point about getting them to put something up front.
Yeah. You know, it's a catch 22 because I always talk about the fact that don't be a pain in the butt, but the people that you're dealing with, they can be the biggest pains in the butt until you can replace them with somebody else.
Exactly.
I remember when I had my construction company many, many years ago, when I first started investing and I had the Freddie Mac Fannie Mae account to rehab the foreclosures around here. And I had this one guy that owned the Freddie Mac account and he gave out all of the construction deals and he was the biggest pain in the ass. I mean, the biggest one. I was still living in a one bedroom apartment. I had Chris Jones was my secretary and we would hang up the phone from the guy's name was Joe. hang up the phone, slam the phone down, and both go, F you, Joe, F you, Joe. But every time we talk to Joe, I say, hey, Joe, how's it going? Yeah, what do we want to look at today? But he, for, at that particular time, he was like 3/4 of our revenues, that Freddie Mac account. So you got to know what you got to do.
Yeah, we're going, yeah, no problem. We can get those reports taken care of. Nope, you know, we'll get that handled for you. And at the same time, afterwards, we're going, we gotta backfill. We gotta replace these guys because they're a pain.
Yeah. So you got to do what you got to do until you don't have to do it anymore. All right, we're going to go into the next round of the interview. It's called Lightning Round, okay? So I'm going to ask you guys brief questions, all right? I'm going to start with Charles. I'm going to start with Adam because you're on the screen right now. And these are quick questions. And they're kind of they're different. This is a fun round, okay? So we're just gonna go back and forth. So Adam, scale of 1 to 10, how good are you at keeping secrets?
7.
Charles, Godzilla or King Kong?
Godzilla.
Who was your first celebrity crush? Adam.
Jennifer Love Hewitt.
Small world, me too.
Actually, you can both answer these questions. Charles, morning or night person?
Morning.
Adam.
Morning.
If you could travel anywhere back in time, where would you go?
Dinosaurs.
New York City in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm. Favorite pizza topping?
Pepperoni.
Extra cheese.
Are whoopie pies really pies?
No.
Charles?
What was that?
Are whoopie pies really pies?
You know, it's a good question. I'm going to say no.
All right. Being from New York, that's a New England thing, right?
Yeah.
Favorite childhood TV star?
I was a big Saved by the Bell fan. So Zach, I guess, from Saved by the Bell.
And he just recently passed away. Did you hear that news?
No.
He passed away about a week and a half ago.
I was very saddened by that.
Yeah.
He's a young guy.
Yeah, very young. Charles, your favorite TV show, childhood TV character or show?
You know what? I was also a big Saved by the Bell fan, but pro wrestling's always been my first thing. So Hulk Hogan.
Hulk Hogan. You know, in my day, it was Bruno Sammartino, Chief J. Strongbow, The Sleeper Hold, Pedro Morales, classic. Last Halloween costume?
Batman.
Charles?
Repeat that question one more time.
Last Halloween costume?
Oof, it's been a long time. I don't even remember. It's been about 25 years, so I'm not sure.
All right, one final question. Do fish get thirsty?
Yes.
Also yes.
All right. Well, that's it. So that was another edition of Deal Lab, 64 units in Charlotte with Charles and Adams. And we will see you on the next edition.
You've been listening to the Multifamily Deal Lab podcast, where the deals get done. If you'd like to learn more, visit davesfreebook.com. And don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review and hit that subscribe button so you don't miss an episode. Thanks for listening.